Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The bruising battle for Lord Stanley's monstrous mug has checked half the original postseason combatants onto various golf courses. For some projections regarding the team still mucking it up in mid-May, we invoke now the L.A. Times princess of the plexiglass, Our Lady of the Lit Lamp, Helene Elliott. Hello, Helene.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. By virtue of Minnesota's remarkable comeback against the vaunted Vancouver Canucks, the Wild are in the NHL's conference finals after only 3 years in the league. This has got to feel like a great gift to some very deserving and long-suffering hockey fans.
Who said virtue had anything to do with it? I don't know. It's been, pardon the pun, quite a wild playoff. Ha, ha, ha.
That's, yeah. I'm moving right along, Helene.
It's been interesting. I know there's been people complaining that, well, nobody's going to watch because it's Anaheim and Minnesota. But, I mean, who said that the Detroit Red Wings have to be in it every year? And if they were, or Detroit or Colorado were in it every year, then people would complain that it's boring. There's no competitiveness in the league. I mean, you can't have it both ways.
Well, I agree with you. I think it is exciting that Minnesota is there. But I can't help but be just a little disappointed that now there's no chance that we see an all-Canadian Stanley Cup final. That would have been fun, don't you think?
Well, maybe, but I mean, you know, look at the number of Canadians on the rosters of each of the teams. It's not like, you know, these teams are made up of all Americans or all Swedes or whatever. I mean, there's the Canada, you know, Canadian team thing kind of bothers me a little bit. It was like last night before the game, It was as if the virtue of Canada as a nation depended on the Canucks winning, and it was just kind of a little much.
The Wild's opponent will be the Mighty Ducks. Can the Ducks provide Anaheim with a second pro championship this year?
Frightening, isn't it? They absolutely can. I think their goaltending is better than Minnesota's goaltending, and as we all know, this time of year, goaltending is what makes the biggest difference.
All right. He's charismatic, he's handsome, and very close to Hollywood. Whether or not the Ducks advance into the finals, the future would seem to be very bright for Anaheim goaltender Jean-Sebastien Giguere. Am I right?
I thought you were talking about yourself for a second.
Oh,
wait,
well,
a minute.
I let other people draw that sort of conclusion. You know.
How modest of you. Jiggy made his first national TV appearance on the Jimmy Kimmel Show last week, which I guess maybe five or six people saw outside of the Kimmel family. But it's tough when you're in the position that the Ducks are. It's kind of like how the Angels are in relation to the Dodgers. You know, you're always kind of the younger brother, the pesky younger brother, and you kind of get ignored. For whatever attention is paid to hockey in Southern California, it's generally paid to the Kings, and always was, because even over the years when Gretzky was there, he certainly drew all the attention himself. But, you know, there's a limited market for hockey endorsements and hockey players, and I don't think you'll see the nation-heavy craze for Jean-Sebastien Giguere, although he's a very nice guy.
Well, do fans in Southern California get the opportunity to ignore a Stanley Cup finalist?
Well, probably. Isn't that a frightening thought? Whoever thought we'd say the words Mighty Ducks and Stanley Cup Finals in the same sentence, other than the Mighty Ducks bought tickets to watch the Stanley Cup Finals? But, you know, again, I think it's terrific for the sense of competitiveness that it's a different team in there. It's different stories. It's just something different to look at, and I'm all for it.
In the Eastern Conference, the Ottawa Senators have been the best team all year, but the opponent they will face, the New Jersey Devils, have a reputation for ruining Stanley Cup dreams. Who do you see getting out of that series?
I like New Jersey. Again, I think the goaltending is better there. Martin Brodeur is time-tested. He's steady. He's got a great temperament. This guy isn't rattled by anything, and the senators have shed most of their label of being chokers. But this is a big test for them. But I like New Jersey better in this one.
All right. Let's suppose that you have accurately predicted the semifinal series. Who do you like to take the cup home?
Well, first of all, that's a big suppose.
but it's one we do all the time. Nobody remembers what folks say anyway.
Oh, the people write me letters and emails when I get them wrong. It's never when I'm right, although there may not be that much opportunity, but we'll let that one go by. I would say New Jersey. Can you imagine that, a New Jersey-Anaheim Stanley Cup final? Good Lord. That's just, I think Lord Stanley is spinning in his grave somewhere, but that's how it would go, I think.
Helene Elliott is the L.A. Times A-Line Athena and Only a Game's matriarch of Moose Jaw. Thank you, Helene.
Thank you.
The National Hockey League's Ottawa Senators, possibly the best team in pro hockey, have spent this season in limbo. Only a Game's Dave Naylor reports on Canada's capital team that would like a Stanley Cup this spring, along with a side order of fiscal stability.
It was a familiar scene last weekend. The Ottawa Senators, cheered by a packed house of rabid fans, convinced their team is on the way to a Stanley Cup. And they just might be right. Ottawa has won more games this season than any team in the National Hockey League. And with a win over New Jersey in the conference final, fans in this city will see their wildest dream come true. But there's another part of the Senators' story that has nothing to do with hockey. It's all about money, which the Senators ran out of back in January, forcing the team into bankruptcy. But while the team has had to borrow money month to month just to survive, on the ice it's been a different story. For players like Mike Fisher, who grew up just 2 hours from Ottawa, ignoring the off-ice issues hasn't always been easy.
Obviously we've been through a lot of adversity this year, and with the team not knowing if we're going to be in Ottawa or moving, and that's kind of been on the outside of our minds, I guess, throughout the season. But at the same time, we've had such a good season that we've been able to build on winning and sticking together as a team and having fun that way and trying to put aside those worries off the ice. And we ultimately know that we can't control those things that go on and outside of the game, and we know that the better we play this year, we knew that the more chance the team would stay here, and we've done our part and our job and so far, and we want to build and we're halfway towards our ultimate goal of winning the cup.
For Senators fans, this has been the best and worst of all possible years rolled into one. Each day, fans open the paper to see their team at the top of the standings. Then they glance down to read other stories about the team's financial woes and its murky future. Chris Stevenson is a sports columnist and radio host in Ottawa. He says the story of this season's Senators has been unlike any he's covered.
Always in the background, there's this kind of buzz that you've always got one ear to the ground to find out what was happening with the ownership situation, because it was so up and down. It's going into receivership, it's going to be moved. So if you can imagine, you have enough on your plate day to day just trying to cover trades and rumors and who's in the lineup and who is out, without having this whole other agenda going on in the background of the future of the team and who is going to be owning it. And when you went to school, I would recommend now for anybody who's thinking about being a sports writer that they minor in get some kind of financial background to be able to deal with bankruptcy trustees and accountants and everybody else.
Understanding why a hockey team in the hockey mad capital of Canada went broke isn't easy. The expansion Senators joined the league in 1992, but were too heavily financed from day one. The debt grew until January of this year, when a plan by owner Rod Brydon to refinance the team collapsed. Brydon tried to save his investment in the ensuing weeks, but in February he gave up the fight. Since then, Toronto billionaire Eugene Melnyk has declared he plans to buy the Senators and keep the team in Ottawa. Though a lot of details remain to be worked out, defenseman Chris Phillips says he would welcome an end to the long string of questions surrounding this franchise.
Every season, it seems like there has been one distraction or another off the ice, and some highs, some lows. It's been a roller coaster, and when you go through that, there's a lot of emotion, and at this point now, with where we are in the playoffs and what seems to be getting resolved as far as the ownership deal, I think it's a lot of excitement all kind of put into one ball, and everyone's riding a big high right now.
Though many believe the team's future is secure, fans in this city have learned that nothing is certain when it comes to the Senators' ownership. Stevenson says that even as fans cheer their team towards a Stanley Cup berth, in the backs of their minds, they're just not sure where this team might be playing next fall.
And I think until, you know, Eugene Melnyk's name is on the nameplate out front is of the Corral Center as the official owner, and it's all signed and sealed, I think there's still going to be some worry that, you know, they could win the Stanley Cup here, and the parade next fall could be, when they hand out the rings, it could be somewhere else. It could be the longest parade in history. It could start in Ottawa and end in Portland.
The Ottawa Senators host the New Jersey Devils this evening in Game 1 of the NHL's Eastern Conference Final. For Only a Game, I'm Dave Naylor in Ottawa.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. In sync with the current trend toward career shifting, Justin Timberlake is joining the cable network Turner Sports as a correspondent. He will cover the British Open and report on the NBA, the NASCAR season, and college football. An executive producer for Turner Sports said of the Timberlake signing, "We are excited at what this unique marriage between the world of sports and entertainment can bring to our high-profile sports property." Among Mr. Timberlake's qualifications for the new position is his status as a, quote, self-confessed football fan. Has unique written all over it, doesn't it?
I'm Dolores Handy with the sports headlines. In yesterday's American League action, Baltimore bested Kansas City 15-5 and then edged the Royals 5-4 in the second game of their doubleheader. Tampa Bay blanked Detroit 2-0. Minnesota shut out Boston 5-0. And Cleveland topped Texas 9-5. Elsewhere, Anaheim tripped Toronto 6-1. Oakland beat the Yankees 7-2. And Seattle vanquished Chicago 6-3. For Only a Game, I'm Dolores Handy in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a short history of Textile League baseball. But first, the Giants fans are happy, though they know it's only May. In Detroit, on the other hand, the Tigers need to play about 800 ball from now until the summer's close if they are to make every fan there stop holding his nose. Before the email begins to roll in from Detroit, let's bring in somebody who knows more than I do about what's up in various ball yards throughout the land, Tim Kirkchin of ESPN and ESPN.com. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. It took all of a month and a half for the Yankees to prove that they are, in your immortal words, still the Yankees. They've had a great start. They have the best record in baseball. Can they stay this hot?
Well, I don't think they can stay this hot, Bill, but I think it proves again exactly how deep the Yankees are, that they've been off to this start
without arguably their most indispensable player, Derek Jeter, who has won it bad, and really with almost nothing from Mariano Rivera, who's probably the best relief pitcher in the game. So it just shows you that no matter what happens to the Yankees after a tumultuous spring filled with bickering and arguing and all sorts of problems, they come out of the gate like this. I think it just shows everybody when the Yankees want to be good, they can be as good as they want to be.
The defending National League champions, the San Francisco Giants, are not far behind the Yankees in terms of their record. They're in first place in the West by several games at this point. And Barry Bonds hasn't played particularly well so far. Does he need to for the Giants to maintain?
Well, I think he has to get really hot at some point because he is Barry Bonds and he is just about the best player any of us have ever seen. But I think this really bodes well for the Giants that Barry Bonds isn't hitting 300 yet. He has fewer RBIs than Ray Ordonez, who might have the worst swing in the major leagues. Barry Bonds has the best swing. And here we are 6 weeks into the season, and Ordonez has more RBIs. Plus, Barry isn't even close to leading the league in walks, which is an astonishing turn this deep into the season. So I think it just shows you how deep the Giants have been this year, that they can win without a marvelous start from Barry Bonds. But I fully expect him to have a marvelous finish. And it's just a question of how good can the rest of that team play when he gets hot.
The Atlanta Braves shuffled their roster after last season, and lots of people wondered if they would slip this season. But they're in first in the National League East. Is this a surprise as far as you're concerned?
Well, I picked them to win the wild card this year, so I still have them going to the playoffs. But I really expected them to take a step backwards this year, especially after that terrible start. But again, the Braves are the Braves. They are not the Yankees, certainly, but they have done marvelous things over the last 13 or so seasons. And I hope everyone understands what we're watching here, a team that basically goes to the playoffs every year. It never happens in baseball, but the Braves do it. And I hope everyone understands how good a manager Bobby Cox is. He's lost basically 70% of his pitching staff, which was the best pitching staff in the National League last year. And here he's turned it around, brought in all new people, gotten through all these injuries so far, and he's still in first place again. Another remarkable story out of Atlanta.
Perhaps the biggest surprise at the beginning of the season here has been the play of the Kansas City Royals. Always cash-strapped, usually in last place, and the Royals have found their way to the top of their division. What's going on there?
Well, again, Bill, this is the ultimate beauty of baseball, is that I had to do a story in the offseason on the five teams that have no chance to win this year. And, of course, I picked the Kansas City Royals right in the middle of that pack, thinking they lost 100 games last year. How much more safe can I get? And they come out and win 15 out of their first 18 games and are still rolling 6 weeks into the season. This is the best part about baseball, is teams like this make people like me look so stupid sometimes. But what it is the Royals do have some really good young pitchers. But I never thought they could be this good this quickly. And can they keep it up for the whole year? I really don't think so. However, it is the best story in the game so far, is that a team that lost 100 games and seemed guaranteed to lose 100 games again has come out of the gate like this with pitchers that people don't even know who they are. They have a kid named DJ Carrasco on their team who's a Rule 5 guy. Rule 5 people, Bill, are guys that you just hope can stay on the team all year, even if you don't use them. Just keep them on the team, and then you can keep them as your property. This guy's been great. And their stud starter, Runelvis Hernandez, whose name no one can even pronounce in the major leagues, has been probably the second-best starting pitcher in the American League behind Mike Mussina.
I hope that you did include the Tigers in your five teams with no chance because, in fact, despite a recent winning streak, they are flirting with a real historical distinction that I think they would just as soon avoid.
Well, I did pick the Tigers on the top of that, these teams can't win list, so I'm really, really proud of getting that team right so far. This is not a good story, Bill. It's a sad story that the Tigers have gotten this bad. In fact, I talked to Trammell and a bunch of the Tigers last week, and they were saying, among other things, how sad it is that a great tradition like Detroit baseball has fallen this far to the point that these guys on this team are so young now that Trammell asked a few of them this spring, do you guys know who Sparky Anderson is? And he got these blank stares. Guys on his own team had no idea who Sparky Anderson was.
Wow.
And that shows you, again, how young this team is. And these guys are trying to learn the hardest game in the world to play on the major league level, which I contend is impossible, and they're certainly showing that to some degree this year.
Tim Kirkchin covers Major League Baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine. He's our cleanup hitter here at Only a Game. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
On Monday, 52 years after his death, Shoeless Joe Jackson was inducted into a Hall of Fame. Yes, he's still banned from baseball and, as a result, banned from Cooperstown. But that didn't stop the Greater Savannah Athletic Hall of Fame from recognizing the third best hitter in the history of baseball, best known for his role in the 1919 Chicago Black Sox scandal. But in Greenville, South Carolina, Jackson's hometown, Shoeless Joe is also remembered as the most recognizable player to come out of the textile leagues, a loose assemblage of mill-owned teams that thrived in the post-Reconstruction South. Now, through an oral history project, Steve O'Neill, a history professor at Furman University, is trying to save some of the stories to come out of those leagues. Steve O'Neill joins me now from Greenville. Professor O'Neill, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you so much, Bill. I'm happy to be here.
History books tell us about the mill towns that sprung up in the South after the Civil War, but how did it come about that these mills were sponsoring what turned out to be semi-pro baseball leagues?
Well, I think the baseball that was associated with the mill early on was sort of sandlot baseball. This would have been in the 1870s and the 1880s before industrialization fully took root in the Red Hills around Greenville. But by the early 1900s, there was a bit of a labor shortage in the mills, and increasingly mill owners were really competing with one another to provide amenities, and mill-sponsored baseball teams were one of those amenities.
Baseball wasn't the only game played in the mill towns, and it wasn't just adults who were playing. For your oral history project, Ernest Millsap, a basketball player and later athletic director for Dunneen Mill, describes how sports fit into the town life.
That was the main thing in the mill village. You'd start off around the gym, and summertime you'd play softball or baseball, and in the wintertime you'd play football or basketball, and you work up from what they call the midget, and then the C team, and the B team, then the A team. You almost had to be a pro to play with the A team.
Why were sports so important to folks in the mill towns?
Well, I think sports were important to them for a lot of the same reasons that sports are important to us today. It provided an outlet of sorts from the daily grind of life, and it provided a nice alternative for the folks who were grinding away at jobs for 10 and 12 hours a day to forget about the many problems that they were facing. Of course, a lot of the mill owners recognized that baseball leagues were important for employee morale. Historians have really, I think, sometimes made too much of mill owner paternalism and the motives behind it in terms of owners trying to look at the bottom line. But I think baseball in particular was a natural for these self-contained mill villages.
The players in the textile leagues had to be working for the mill that they were playing for, but according to Pete Maccabee, a veteran of the Brandon Mill team, that didn't stop the mills from attracting some high-quality players. Let's listen to a little of the interview Mr. Maccabee gave for your project.
You had real good ball players that had been playing AAA and AA and A ball that were jumping the leagues and coming to play textile ball, because they were paying much more than they could get there. And really it was a double pay, because the jobs they gave them were nothing. I mean, it was just a name on payroll only. If you were a real good ball player, like Ralph Harbin was for us, he was a carpenter, and I guess he might have drove about a dozen nails while he was there.
It sounds as if there was a considerable amount of pride involved. The mills really had a stake in providing good ball clubs.
I think there's no question about that. You got to remember that not only were these players fiercely competitive, but the owners and managers who ran the mills were intensely competitive among themselves. Mm-hmm. A lot of them loved the game, had played the game, and wanted to have the very best team in the upstate of South Carolina.
It must have been fascinating for these guys because obviously they were neighbors as well as competitors, and they must have known virtually everybody on the other team every time they faced each other.
That is true, and it's not only the players who were competitive, but as you might imagine, all the residents of the mill villages took great pride, and so these mills just like high school teams in small towns across America today, were symbols of what the Mills represented. And that was true for the very top management all the way down to the lowliest floor sweepers.
Mr. McAbee tells a great story of his first visit to New York City to see the Yankees and Joe DiMaggio play in Yankee Stadium, and he wasn't all that impressed when he got there, I gather.
Bill Dickey was catching, and I mean King Kong Keller in left field, Tommy Hendricks in right field. They had some good ball players, but they had some other players at other positions that you found yourself comparing them with people you'd been playing against or with, and they weren't all that good. I'd have to admit that first time I saw him, I didn't get that good of an impression, because I honestly felt that some of these Texas League players like George Blackwell, Lonnie Holbrook, were just as good at their position than some of the guys were out there at theirs. And a lot of these players, seriously, in all fairness to them now, could have played pro ball if they would have left home. So there was a good caliber of baseball throughout the Texas community.
Now, does that qualify as an unbiased assessment? Is Mr. McAbee right?
Well, I think he's certainly right that the caliber of baseball was probably more than our listeners would expect from an industrial-type league. If I could hazard a comparison, I might say that the quality of play was right around the level maybe of the lowest minor leagues of the 30s or 40s, which would have been, I guess, D-League baseball mm-hmm. at that time. And I think it is true that a number of major league teams use these leagues as sort of an unofficial minor league. Something like 75 to 100 players who cut their teeth in the textile baseball leagues around Greenville in the upstate of South Carolina eventually made it to the big leagues.
And there may have been the odd player who just didn't want to leave home, could have played in the big leagues if he had wanted to leave.
I think there's no question about that, and there's even a couple of instances of big leaguers essentially throwing away their career in order to come back, not so much to work in the mills or even to play for the team, but in some cases just to show up and to support their side in one game or in a couple of games. And I'm thinking here of one of the first big leaguers to come out of the South Carolina Textile League, a fellow named Champ Osteen, who had a short career with the Washington Senators and the New York Highlanders. And the story goes that as the season was moving towards July 1st, Osteen went to his manager in New York and said, "Skip, I'm going to have to take a little time off." And the manager wanted to know if there was some crisis at home, and I wouldn't call it a crisis, but he simply replied that Piedmont was playing Pelzer, and he was needed more down there than he was on the bench in New York City.
That's wonderful. That's terrific.
Yeah.
The textile leagues were put on hold for World War II. The games and the leagues came back briefly after the war, but then soon died out. Let's listen to Ernest Millsap talking about those days.
When these companies combined, you know, if they couldn't make money off of it, they said if the sports inside their mill is all right, but they quit sponsoring it. But I believe what really happened, TV came out in 53 or 4, you know, WFBC, and people got staying home watching television instead of going to the ball game. And I believe that's really hurt.
It's kind of like the more things change, the more they stay the same, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is, and I think he's right about TV. That was probably the most obvious of the cultural changes that really spelled the doom of Textile League baseball. But I think what he's talking about there is a number of different aspects of modernization in post-World War II culture. Certainly automobiles played a role in that, and not only were cars widely available, but for the first time, textile workers could afford cars. That, in turn, is related to the decision of mill owners to divest themselves of the villages. Of course, during the early days, the factory was not the only aspect. That was simply sort of the center, symbolic and economic center of a much larger complex. The village was completely owned by the towns. They were company towns.
Yeah, one virtue of a company town is you got a built-in fan base. No question about that.
That's exactly right. But in the 1940s and the 1950s, for a variety of reasons, the mill owners began to sell the houses, and non-workers were moving in, workers were moving out, and there simply was not that vital connection between the workers in the mill and the residents of the villages and the ball teams that were on the field.
Steve, when you talk to people in the South and in South Carolina today, are they aware of the history of the textile teams?
My answer would depend entirely upon how old they are. The folks who are 60 and 70 and 80 years old, whether they were part of the mill culture or strictly part of the middle class in the towns, were aware and they remember back with great fondness for those earlier days and for the contests on the diamond. I think the sons and daughters of those people, even the folks who played in the mill leagues, really don't know very much at all about not only the baseball that was part of mill life, but the mill life in general. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of unfortunate. That's what we're trying to do with this project. We're trying to make those stories, not only of the baseball players, but of all the people in the villages, available to a much wider audience.
Steve O'Neill is a history professor at Furman University. His oral history project will be one of the showpieces of a new museum in Greenville, South Carolina. Professor O'Neill, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's been my pleasure, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senior citizens dance in Miami's Little Havana. Horns blare in the bombed-out streets of Kosovo. And steel drums ring below Broadway on a New York subway platform. I'm Scott Simon. These sounds of our world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Dolores Handy with these sports headlines. In yesterday's National League action, St. Louis clobbered the Cubs 6-3. Los Angeles lit up Montreal 9-5. Philadelphia flummoxed Houston 5-3. Arizona shut out Pittsburgh 5-0. And Cincinnati cinched Milwaukee 7-4. Elsewhere, San Diego edged the Mets 5-4, San Francisco beat Atlanta 9-2, and Florida foiled Colorado 5-4. For Only a Game, I'm Dolores Handy in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, injury-free hockey, except for potential blisters on your fingertips. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me for a discussion of the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Excuse me.
I got blisters on my fingers!
That was exactly the reference I hoped everybody would get. Let's begin with the NBA playoffs. On Thursday, the Dallas Mavericks set the NBA playoff record for points and a half with an astonishing 83 on their way to a 132-110 victory over Sacramento. That series is now even at one game apiece, and maybe the Mavericks don't have to play defense.
Well, that series can now start, because in both cases, half the cast didn't show up. Yeah, the interesting thing about the playoffs so far is they're turning almost completely, particularly in the West, on critical injuries. Sacramento has lost Bobby Jackson, Ambrose Weber, The Lakers have lost Rick Fox and Devin George, and they are in big trouble against San Antonio, which is really too bad because otherwise the Western Conference playoffs look like one of the great series of playoffs we've had in a long time.
Speaking of that Lakers series in which the Lakers do trail, I wonder if the big Aristotle has managed to philosophize his way to a positive attitude in any case.
Well, I think the big Aristotle is facing his Socrates moment over the next couple of games. The interesting thing is that San Antonio has largely guarded him with one player, usually David Robinson, but sometimes the manfully effective Malik Rose is giving up about 8 inches and about 100 pounds. And the other thing that's happening is the referees are starting to call what Shaq, I'm sure, would refer to as ticky-tack fouls and what the rest of us would consider eight killed at the intersection. But there's a lot of offensive fouls being called on him all of a sudden, which is a great – it's not something you see in the NBA that often, that a guy's trademark offense starts getting called.
In the NBA East, there's a very good chance that the conference finals will pit the defensively strong Detroit Pistons against the defensively strong New Jersey Nets. And if that matchup occurs, I suppose every game will be 63-62.
Well, that's not necessarily true. It will be true only if Detroit can be as good defensively as New Jersey is offensively. New Jersey is a fine offensive team. They're one of the best running teams the NBA has seen in over a decade. Jason Kidd is a perfect up-tempo point guard. He's got young forwards like Richard Jefferson to run with him. That will be more of a contrast in styles than it might seem.
Jason Kidd's wife, Jumana, did not attend the Nets-Celtics game in Boston last night. New Jersey head coach Byron Scott had asked her not to because he was concerned about behavior of the fans at the Fleet Center. Do players, their wives, and fans of the visiting team in general suffer greater abuse in Boston than elsewhere in the NBA?
I mean, this is an angels on the head of the pin argument. I have heard things at Boston games, particularly in the 1980s, that I heard in no other arenas anywhere in America. That having been said, this has been a week of people saying things they shouldn't have said. Mm. The controversy that began with Boston Globe columnist Bob Ryan's rather untoward and ill-considered remarks on a television show is now metastasized into Byron Scott calling the Boston Celtics fans crazy in a radio interview in New York. Somebody from the NBA has got to rein this in, is at least got to call everybody together and say, look, the rhetoric is way out of hand right now, and this volatile situation is getting worse. The one argument I do resist, though, is the notion that Jumana Kidd and her son don't have the right to sit anywhere they want because their presence someplace might instigate some bad behavior on the part of drunken louts in the crowd. Do something about the drunken louts.
Michael Jordan may make a comeback as a front office guy next season, Charlie, but it will not be in Washington. He was fired on Tuesday. I gather Washington Wizards owner Abe Pollin did not think Jordan's name on the letterhead would do the team as much good as a better president might.
Look, Michael Jordan is an interesting character in a lot of ways. He has not been a very good front office executive. There's no indication that he would become a very good front office executive. He's departing in a very miserable and ungentlemanly fashion. He got fired. Guess what? It's probably the first time anything bad has happened to him professionally since he got cut from his junior high basketball team. Go to the casino, win some money, and relax, Michael.
Well, now, it's interesting you bring it up in that context. Gambling, of course, got Michael Jordan in trouble once. Before that, it got Pete Rose in trouble. And now, moral authority William Bennett has apparently acknowledged that he's been known to have trouble walking by the odd video poker machine.
Pardon me for a moment. Ha, 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 ho, 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 and a couple of tra-la-las. Hey, Bill, reread The Grasshopper again, pal. $8 million in the video part. First of all, I do not believe that he lost $8 million just playing slot machines at video poker.
It would take a long time, wouldn't it?
Because those are, first of all, they're the two biggest sucker games in the casino. You would have to bet, by my calculation, somewhere over $12 million to lose $8 million playing video poker.
It has not escaped your notice, I'm sure, that the Women's Soccer World Cup may well be returning to the U.S. 8 or 12 or 16 years ahead of schedule. Charlie, have you cleared your calendar for the fall?
Absolutely. We'll both be there with bells on. You should see me in bells. Oh, it's a. It was supposed to be held this September in China, but the SARS epidemic has knocked that out. Apparently, the United States, Australia, Brazil, and Sweden were all interested, but it looks like, given the fact that it is the U.S. team and it's following the drive of this event now, that FIFA, one of my favorite sports acronyms, is going to put the tournament here.
The International Olympic Committee enhanced its reputation for grasping the obvious this week by concluding that when a new Iraqi Olympic Committee is formed, it should not include the guys who used to torture athletes, which seems very reasonable to me.
Well, it seems reasonable to me. If you've been following our hit-and-miss reconstruction of Iraq, though, you find out that we're using an awful lot of the same police and an awful lot of the same firemen and an awful lot of the same people who run things. But considering that I think most of Iraq's previous Olympic Committee is probably under 8 tons of rubble somewhere right now, this is probably a good idea. They should organize Iraq's Olympic team, as far as I'm concerned, in Florida and just get them out of the whole place for a while and let them train.
The Mets are among several ball clubs off to disappointing starts, Charlie, but at least the Tigers, the Padres, the Devil Rays, and the Brewers, who are also in that category, can claim that their players are paying attention during the losses. I gather that the same cannot necessarily be said of Mets shortstop Ray Sanchez.
You remember, it is better to look good than to be good. Ray Sanchez got himself a haircut.
And he looks marvelous.
unfortunately, the beleaguered Mets closer, Armando Benitez, got tangled up in this when he was alleged to be the barber in this particular instance. That was later denied, so the person who actually cut Ray Sanchez's hair remains at large, although my money is on the famous Sal the Barber Magley.
On June the 3rd, the Bisbee Douglas Copper Kings of the Arizona-Mexico League will hold Ted Williams Night. That would be a heartwarming story, I suppose, except that the giveaway grimly acknowledges Ted's current state.
Ted's current situation. The first 500 fans to the Bisbee Douglas Copper Kings game on Ted Williams Night will get a popsicle. I can't make this stuff up.
Finally, Charlie, if he were running for re-election, and if I were a Canadian citizen, Prime Minister Jean Chrétien would have my vote on the basis of his honesty. When asked about his television viewing habits, he admitted that the televised prime ministerial candidates debate on Monday was the runner-up in his TV room.
Of course it was. He watched hockey,
He
watched hockey, eh? It's not like they're holding this debate at the beginning of the season. They're holding it during the playoffs. Zut alors!
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, and of course he joins me each week on Only a Game to discuss the sports news of the week. Thank you, Charlie.
I get back to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide.
We're going to have a TV party tonight. All right! We're going to have a TV party, all right!
Tonight! We've got nothing better to do than watch TV and have a couple of brews.
There's more information about this week's stories on our website, onlyagame.org, where you can also read the latest sports news, browse the Only a Game store, or get in touch with us.
We've got nothing better to do than watch TV and have a couple of brews. Don't talk about anything else.
Years ago, I was trying to put together a roundtable discussion for a radio piece, and I called Lee Montville, then a local newspaper columnist, to see if he'd join the fun. He listened to my proposition, a conversation in the studio about some sports issue so important that I've forgotten what it was, and then he said, "Thanks, but I don't think so." "Why not?" I asked. "Well," he said, "half the time when I do this kind of thing, I end up thinking that what I said was pretty dumb." Montville's point was that he could trust himself when he wrote something, but not necessarily when he just opened his mouth and let it rip. I was irritated with him at the time. Hey, I was trying to make some radio, but in the years that have passed, I've come to see the columnist's point. Writing is about thinking ideas through, choosing the right words, and, if necessary, recasting the beginning and the middle of an argument if you find yourself somewhere you didn't anticipate being when you reach the end. And writing, even writing under deadline, almost always gets edited by somebody else. Talking is different. Even people who talk on TV for a living about important matters sometimes scramble names, dates, and other facts. And sometimes they say things they wish they hadn't said. But by the time they come to that realization, the dumb words are out there. In print, Boston Globe columnist Bob Ryan would not have let his distaste for what he regards as the opportunistic behavior of Jason Kidd's wife carry him to the point where he'd write, "I'd like to smack her." That comment was a product of the environment of sports talk TV, where the fare is sometimes mildly amusing, but much more often bone-dumb and repetitious, and like its radio counterpart, frequently offensive. That's not to excuse the comment. Ryan himself doesn't excuse it. He's apologized and acknowledged his words as, quote, inappropriate and offensive. Readers of Bob Ryan's columns and books know him as an energetic, opinionated writer whose enthusiasm for the games he chronicles has survived the grind of decades of travel and deadlines. Now, sadly, a lot of people who've never read his work know him as the guy who said he'd like to smack a player's wife. In this case, talk wasn't cheap. Bob Ryan's remark cost him a month's pay, the temporary loss of his column, and the joy of the playoffs, which he appreciates mightily. It would be nice to imagine that some good might come out of the episode, and that other folks who talk rather than write about sports might exercise some restraint, even upgrade their product. But Bob Ryan's circumstances notwithstanding, there's really no reason to think that'll happen. The so-called generation gap yawns and closes as attitudes change and as more products hit the American market. But there's one new old game bringing young and old together despite the allure of more advanced gigaws, electrical gymcracks, and cyber whatsamahoosies. Only a game's Gabe O'Connor has our story.
Tickets for Blue.
Jillian's in Boston has a big video arcade for grown-ups. There you won't see many kids with pockets bulging with quarters, but you will see adults throw cash and credit cards in sophisticated games that put to shame the Pac-Man they played when they were younger. But tonight, down in the building's lowest level, people are playing games in vogue when people wore butterfly collars and kids dreamt of Bobby Orr. Welcome to the first annual Boston Challenge, the unofficial table hockey championship of North America. The bar floor has been cleared and long banquet tables are set end-to-end, filled with table hockey rinks controlled by the best players on the continent.
Nice shot.
The game is simple. Players control miniature plastic hockey men with rods you can push, pull, and rotate to move a miniature puck along a miniature hockey rink made of plastic, cardboard, and metal. Table hockey seems like a trip around the Maypole compared to the virtual reality chaos going on upstairs, but Steve Bernstein, one of the tournament's creators, wants his game to be more than a curiosity from the past.
We want to put together the United States Table Hockey Association. There's never been one governing body to manage all the different satellite tournaments that go around. We want to open it up and let people know that there are people that play this extremely well.
Some may smugly chuckle at the idea of a national table hockey league, but there's a dedicated core of players from all over the world who take the game very seriously, like 38-year-old Bruce Turner from Kitchener, Ontario.
You will not see any elite players drink any alcohol until the tournament's over. You'll only see water.
What happens after the tournament?
Well, then they'll have some. Then there'll be a party.
Table hockey also serves as an excuse for friends to gather, and the internet lets players from around the world communicate with each other. Ironically, it was this high-tech solution that probably saved low-tech table hockey in the mid-90s. 40-year-old Graham Barber, who came here from Denver, rediscovered the game a few years back and found a ready-made group of table hockey buddies.
We can talk to each other. There's all kinds of sites that show you different set moves. We find something new, we can punch it in the computer and say, hey, I'm doing this now. You know, and they can pick it up, and it's made it a lot easier to find other people to play. That's the biggest thing.
It hasn't been easy for the older generation to find young players to pass on the love of table hockey, says 28-year-old Kenny Dubois.
Still morally of an older person's game because for a long time, the game wasn't being introduced and it wasn't being given to the youth because of the video game coming in. It was always the new video game winds up under the tree, and that was the thing that people have been playing all the time for the last 20 years, and the table hockey game has kind of been lost.
According to table hockey aficionados, when they finally try it, many kids take to the game. But some kids won't give up their GameCube with a DVD player and Dolby surround sound to try something as quaint as table hockey. Corey Walker, one of the several teens in the tournament, enjoys playing the game with his father, But if he was given the choice between hockey and a video game...
I don't have the money to purchase a game system, so I resort to this.
If you had a chance to get a game system, would you do it, or would you still play table hockey?
I'd probably go with the game system.
So intent were older players to include as many youngsters as possible that, according to Barber, they did the unthinkable and dropped a beer sponsorship so the kids could be allowed to play in the tournament.
Miller was going to give some prizes, and we Kenny and Steve, and they talked to a few of us, and we decided, you know, let's forget the prizes to make sure the kids can come here. But that's the future of the sport, you know. That's the kids that, you know, I got another 20 years to play. They got 40 more years to play.
At age 50, Steve Bernstein has played table hockey for almost 40 years. The game he loves may be enjoying its biggest resurgence since the good old days of his youth. But as he lists the reasons why there were some no-shows today, one realizes this game still has a long way to go before it becomes mainstream.
Well, one guy couldn't get a babysitter. Another one got sick. Another one, who knows? Why would anybody drop out of the tournament? I don't get it.
Well, maybe they had to work this weekend. I mean, have you seen how expensive video games are nowadays? For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Boston.
That shot.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from Michelle Cousineau at CBC Ottawa, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or scope out some table hockey players, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Pamela Blake, wife of table hockey competitor Roger Owens, who tells Gabe O'Connor what she and her husband would do after the completion of the all-day-long 2003 Boston Challenge.
We'll go antiquing tomorrow.
Well, that ought to fix his wagon. Of course, Roger may find an antique table hockey game out there somewhere. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio. Public Radio.